Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. This is part two of our discussion with the director of the Linus Pauling Institute, Dr. Baltz Fry. He is a professor of biochemistry and biophysics and an experienced vitamin researcher. And in part one, we talked a little bit, we addressed some of the critics of vitamins who claim that the debate is over, let's not waste our time doing vitamin research. Well, that's precisely what today's guest is involved in with a team of researchers at Oregon State University, and is one of the foremost nutrition research laboratories in the world. So, Dr. Fry, there is also a concern and discussion over antioxidants. You know, antioxidants became sort of a buzzword, the notion that, you know, we can't get enough of them. Everybody has heard about the free radical theory of aging and disease, and we must combat free radicals, free radical quenchers. That's part of our lexicon when we go to the health food store or the vitamin store. And yet, there's some people who suggest that, well, there's a plus side and a minus side to antioxidants, that antioxidants in some cases could be deleterious. So you talk a little bit about this, the redox phenomenon, in some of your writings. Share your thoughts on that.
Right. So it's all about the balance of reactive oxygen species, which are free radicals and other reactive species derived from oxygen, and how they are balanced with antioxidants in your body. And your body has mechanisms of producing these reactive oxygen species, which tells you they must have an important role in normal biological function. But the body also makes a lot of antioxidants, including antioxidant proteins and antioxidant enzymes, such as superoxide dismutase, which dismutates or basically neutralizes the dangerous superoxide radical, which actually Linus Pauling first described. You have catalase, which takes care of hydrogen peroxide, which is another one of these reactive oxygen species, and many other antioxidants.
Including glutathione peroxidase and so on.
That's right. And you also have, in addition to the proteins and the enzymes, you have small molecule antioxidants. And some of them you make in your body, and glutathione is the prime example. So the cells make glutathione, which is a very good antioxidant. And actually, your cells are full of glutathione, millimolar concentrations, which is a high concentration. It's really a very significant concentration that is very important, both as an antioxidant in its own right, because glutathione can directly react with and neutralize these free radicals and reactive oxygen species, but it also acts as a cofactor or a reducing substrate for certain enzymes like glutathione peroxidase that you just mentioned, which can basically neutralize hydrogen peroxide and lipid hydroperoxide, so oxidized fat, basically. And then there is another contribution to the antioxidant network, and that's dietary antioxidants. And that's where, again, a lot of the controversy or confusion comes in. And vitamin C is a very, very good antioxidant. I contend it's basically the only significant dietary antioxidant on the water-soluble side. And on the lipid-soluble side, the antioxidants that protect the fat in your body against oxidative damage, it's vitamin E. So vitamin E and vitamin C are the most important dietary antioxidants, in my view. Now, there are these flavonoids, and sometimes they're called phytonutrients. They're not nutrients. They are just phytochemicals. They're chemicals in plants, fruits and vegetables, but they have no nutritive value. They have no
caloric value, or they have no they're not a,
right.
They're neither fish nor fowl. They're not protein. They're not fats. They're not carbohydrates per se.
Right, and they are not, like vitamins, essential cofactors for enzymes.
Right.
They have no known biological function. But they are obviously an important part of your diet, excuse me, especially if you eat lots of fruits and vegetables. What they do, they can induce antioxidant defenses in your body. So you have a certain system that can, excuse me, that can respond to these compounds and generate, for example, a lot of glutathione in your cells. So they are indirect antioxidants. But again, the important point that I'm trying to make here is that you have to see the antioxidants from the diet in the context of what's already in the body. The body makes a lot of antioxidants itself, and many of them are enzymes which can basically neutralize an unlimited number of free radicals, because an enzyme is not being used up in the process of the reaction that it catalyzes. So, these sacrificial antioxidants like glutathione or ascorbate, they're being used up if they scavenge reactive oxygen species. So you may run out of them if you have severe oxidative stress, but these antioxidant enzymes, they are always around. They're not going to go away, and they're always going to be there to neutralize these free radicals.
But can we go overboard on antioxidants? Linus Pauling, advocate of high-dose vitamin C, some people suggest high-dose vitamin E, and there are critics of that, saying that some studies suggest that the body actually needs free radicals, that it's sort of a yin and the yang. Yes, we need antioxidants, but we also need to allow free radicals to perform certain cellular functions. And oxygen, in fact, is a free radical. And some of the therapies that are used by alternative medicine doctors, ozone, hydrogen peroxide, high-dose intravenous vitamin C, these are thought to be pro-oxidative, and maybe they have a therapeutic value as kind of a cleanup crew for the body.
Yes, very good. Yeah, so that's certainly true. There is clearly a role of reactive oxygen species in normal physiological function, but also in disease. And I think the most important reactive oxygen species is hydrogen peroxide in that respect. So we know that if you expose cells to hydrogen peroxide, there is a dose-dependent response. So at low concentrations of hydrogen peroxide, you actually stimulate cell proliferation. So the cells grow, they divide, and this is because hydrogen peroxide triggers certain intracellular processes that increase gene transcription, and many of these genes are required for growth. These are growth factors and other proteins that are required for growth and division of these cells. Now, that's a good thing in development as you grow and as you need more tissues and more cells, but it is a bad thing if you're talking about cancer. You know, these same processes that are required for normal development later on are supposed to be shut down because you don't want to have cell proliferation, which then grows into a tumor. So that's at low concentrations of hydrogen peroxide. If you then increase the concentration of hydrogen peroxide, your cell will then actually go in the opposite direction. It will first undergo apoptosis, which is controlled cell death, and eventually will undergo necrosis, which is just cell death, cell killing by a rather random and chaotic process. So you have this biphasic response. At low concentration, hydrogen peroxide causes cell proliferation and is required for normal cell growth. At higher concentrations, it kills cells. And so the flip side of that is that, okay, antioxidants that prevent hydrogen peroxide from doing its job may have a dual effect. If you're talking about low concentrations of hydrogen peroxide and you prevent those from doing their job of stimulating cell growth, that could be a bad thing in development. It could be a good thing in cancer because you don't want cells to proliferate.
That's maybe at the level of maybe cancer prevention. You know, lots of fruits and vegetables containing these polyphenol compounds may confer some protection, right?
Yeah, exactly. And this is basically how they are thought to work in cancer chemo prevention. They upregulate through this signal transduction process, and a transcription factor called NRF2, which then in turn upregulates glutathione synthesis and antioxidant and detoxification enzymes. So that's how antioxidants protect against cancer in the early stages, cancer chemo prevention. But then in the later stages, antioxidants may protect your cells from undergoing apoptosis or necrosis. And that's a bad thing because you want your cancer cells to die preferentially through apoptosis, which is a controlled way of getting rid of cells. But if you have too much of antioxidant protection, then you may prevent this apoptosis from happening.
Well, is this a rationale for? Yeah, it's a complicated story, but it's one continual theme that we hear from oncologists, particularly those administering chemotherapy and radiation, is they wave their arms and they say, don't take any supplements, particularly stay away from antioxidants, because sometimes they even claim that the antioxidants feed the cancer or that they counteract the effects of the killing chemotherapy and radiation.
Exactly.
And so, you know, what are we to tell the patients? You know, just eat refined, Wonder Bread and distilled water, you know, with no antioxidants at all?
No, I think, you know, first of all, you know, if you think about it, what we just discussed, there are all these antioxidant enzymes and proteins and the small molecular antioxidants, including glutathione and vitamin C, and the cell is really full of these compounds. There are so many layers of antioxidant defenses, and all these processes are very carefully regulated by the body. It's not very likely that you will make a huge difference, for example, in your vitamin C levels or even glutathione levels, that would then override all of the other mechanisms that you have already in place for antioxidant defenses. So, you know, the dietary antioxidants are really only a small contribution to the overall antioxidant protection, the whole system that you have in yourself. So, you know, that is one factor. The other one is that it's very important to maintain good micronutrient status, especially during chemotherapy, because you're going to get depleted of all of these vitamins and minerals. Radiation chemotherapy is very detrimental to your nutritional status. And so because micronutrients are so important in normal biological function, including immune function and everything else, and these processes, these systems are being compromised by chemotherapy, if you make this even worse by being deficient in certain vitamins and minerals, you are really not doing yourselves a favor. So this argument that vitamin C or vitamin E protects against chemotherapy or protects the cells from apoptosis, you know, it's kind of...
In other words, that protects the cancer cells. What you're saying is that it...
Yeah, cells,
right.
But it's not really based on actual data.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you look at the data, overall the effect of taking antioxidants or just your vitamins and minerals during chemotherapy, it's beneficial. It lowers the side effects of your treatment. It makes sure that you're at least having the levels of your micronutrients that are required for normal physiological function. So it's more important to maintain those things than worry about a hypothetical protective effect. I don't think it exists. I don't think it has been shown. It's all based on kind of theoretical arguments. But
sometimes test tube studies don't actually reveal, you know, this is the whole argument about in vitro versus in vivo, you know, the laboratory tests looking at isolated systems in a test tube sometimes don't reveal what's happening in a living organism or a human.
Right, I agree. And so we have to be careful. I mean, we have to base our recommendations on actual data, and I think they're just not there at this point.
Well, how about this one? You said that vitamin levels are carefully, or nutrient levels are carefully regulated in the body. So one contention of your illustrious predecessor, whose legacy you're carrying out at the Linus Pauling Institute, was that you could load vitamin C to bowel tolerance. And I think at one point Dr. Pauling was taking 17 grams of vitamin C a day. But from what I've learned recently, that may be fallacious, because the body has only a certain capacity to absorb and maintain blood levels of vitamin C. So is there a limit to how much vitamin C you can assimilate if you take it orally?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Exactly, because it's so fine-tuned, you know, the body will only take up so much vitamin C, and then there are certain threshold levels or saturation levels that you cannot exceed, and then the extra vitamin C is excreted in the urine. So you have a kidney threshold, and if you go above a certain concentration of vitamin C in your blood, you just pee it out. And so of the 18 grams, Linus Pauling took 18 grams a day for many years. He probably only absorbed into his body And it was in the GI tract, it went through his GI tract, which may in and of itself have beneficial effects. But what's actually taken up from the GI tract into the body may be 200, 250 milligrams. Because once you're saturated, the body is not going to take up more vitamin C from your diet.
Well, does that argue for people taking just 250 milligrams of vitamin C per day, maybe in divided doses, or should they take more? Or, you know, is there a one-size-fits-all approach to vitamin C supplementation?
Well, there are large individual differences because there are quite a few different polymorphisms, you know, genetic variations in the sodium-dependent vitamin C transporter. So some people have certain problems with vitamin C transport because of that protein being somewhat different. But in general, you see saturation of your body pools if you take somewhere between 250 to 500 milligrams of vitamin C a day. So that's all you really need.
Do you suggest divided doses, or because it seems to be something that's depleted rather quickly? It's a water-soluble vitamin. We sometimes tell people to take vitamin C in two or three doses divided through the day.
Yeah, right. That makes sense, although this may only affect your blood levels. I think your tissue levels, once you're saturated, they are going to be maintained the same whether you take it in one or two doses, because the tissue actually saturates before your plasma saturates.
You know, okay.
Your plasma or your blood levels.
That's like the spillover from your tissue, in effect.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, all the vitamin C that's pumped into the tissues accumulates in your cells over time, and it's not as rapidly exchanged as the vitamin C in your bloodstream.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's reassuring to hear, because people are, you know, compulsively taking massive doses of vitamin C, particularly if they feel they're coming down with a cold or something, and maybe that's not warranted.
Yeah. So that relates to another interesting issue with respect to vitamin C. You know, this idea that vitamin C acts as a kind of a pro-drug in terms of hydrogen peroxide production.
Right.
And, you know, vitamin C...
Well, that would be intravenous vitamin C, correct?
That would be intravenous vitamin C.
Yeah.
So like any antioxidant, it can also act as a prop. So basically, an antioxidant can give away electrons, and this reduces a substrate. But if the substrate happens to be a metal ion, like copper or iron, then the consequence of that is that you actually produce reactive oxygen species. And so this may happen, especially if you have free iron or copper around, or if you have very high concentrations of vitamin C. And this is what Linus Pauling kind of postulated as a possible mechanism by which vitamin C is useful in the treatment of cancer. And he did a number of clinical studies that were not very well controlled and quite controversial, but he found that in those studies, vitamin C seemed to improve quality of life and survival of terminally ill cancer patients. This was then refuted by a couple of studies at the Mayo Clinic.
Where they actually gave oral vitamin C, which is really not the equivalent.
Yeah.
Yeah. He did that work with Dr. Ewan Cameron of Scotland, and then they translated to the Mayo Clinic. They said, well, you see, vitamin C doesn't work. We gave it to our patients who were sick unto death and had failed every form of conceivable therapy at the time, and the vitamin C didn't prolong their lives. Case closed on vitamin C, or so they said.
Exactly, right. And this, you know, was a big controversy at the time, and Linus Pauling, one of the big reasons why he was so controversial.
It was Dr. Mortel's study.
Exactly. Right.
Who himself perished from cancer shortly thereafter, ironically.
Right. Well, yeah, and Linus Pauling died of prostate cancer, but, you know, that's not necessarily, it's anecdotal evidence, and Linus Pauling said he always lived so long because of vitamin C, and, you know, you have to die of something in the end. And
I was thinking he was 90s, I believe, wasn't he?
Excuse me?
He was in his 90s, I believe.
Yeah, he died at 93.
Mm-hmm.
So the big difference, again, as you mentioned, between the Mayo study and the Pauling studies were the route of administration. So vitamin C was given intravenously in most of Pauling's patients, not all of them, but most of them. And in the Mayo Clinic, it was all given orally. And so this idea that the dose makes the difference and may be the key to why vitamin C works with respect to cancer. As picked up by a number of researchers more recently, the most prominent of them being Mark Levine at the National Institutes of Health. And so what he has discovered is that vitamin C at these very high concentrations that you can only achieve through intravenous infusion, not through dietary supplementation, because again, the uptake from GI tract is very limited. But IV vitamin C accumulates in millimolar concentration, and this then actually can generate one of these reactive oxygen species that we already talked about, hydrogen peroxide. And if you produce enough hydrogen peroxide, as we already also discussed, it may cause cell death through different mechanisms, apoptosis, which is the controlled cell death, or necrosis, which is the uncontrolled cell death. And so this is the idea now, that if you infuse very high concentrations of vitamin C, the vitamin C does not produce hydrogen peroxide in the bloodstream, but once it gets into the tissues and the surrounding areas of tumors, it can generate very high concentrations of, well, relatively high concentrations of vitamin of hydrogen peroxide that are high enough to cause these cancer cells to die through apoptosis and necrosis.
And a recent clinical study by my good colleague, Dr. Jeannie Driscoe at Kansas University Medical Center, showed prolonged survival in ovarian cancer patients who concurrently received chemo. They did not eschew conventional therapies. They got chemo and the intravenous vitamin C. It extended their lives by a significant number of months.
Yeah. So there are now more and more papers showing up in the scientific literature that do show beneficial effects in a number of different cancers. Pancreas is one of them that they have been looking at quite extensively, and they find good effects of vitamin C, but it's always in combination with standard chemotherapy or whatever other therapy, because they you know, couldn't ethically withdraw that and just replace it with vitamin C. And that's not what we are suggesting. We are saying that it could be a palliative or adjunctive
therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
And now we understand the mechanisms behind it, and you know, we are still working on this. We have been able to show in our own labs here that yes, indeed, high concentrations of ascorbate produce hydrogen peroxide, and cancer cells are sensitive to killing by hydrogen peroxide, whereas normal cells are not. So you get a nice kind of therapeutic window there. And we are trying to enhance the toxicity of hydrogen peroxide through a number of ways that could even increase the killing of these cancer cells with millimolar ascorbate.
Well, that's fabulous. We're looking forward to hearing the results of that research. What else is on tap at the Linus Pauling Institute? Give us a brief rundown of some of the projects you're engaged in.
Right. So as I mentioned, we are all kind of interested in the concept of orthomolecular medicine, how micronutrients, vitamins and minerals can be used to promote optimum health and prevent disease. And we have three major research areas. One is cancer chemo prevention. It's the focus on the prevention, not so much the therapy. Then we have the second group that looks at cardiometabolic diseases, and the third one at aging. And we are investigating underlying mechanisms of these diseases and the aging process. And two of them really seem to be common to most of these conditions, which is oxidative stress, or what we now call more redox balance. So it's not just oxidative damage, but it's also cell signaling and regulation of these reactive oxygen species at the cellular level and how that affects gene transcription. And then the other one, and there is an increasing emphasis on that, is inflammation, chronic inflammation, which clearly goes up with age and may actually be one of the key underlying mechanisms why advanced age is such a big risk factor for most chronic diseases, cancer in particular, and then of course heart disease and other cardiometabolic diseases. And so we are trying to find micronutrients or dietary factors that address these underlying mechanisms like inflammation and oxidative stress or redox imbalance, and thereby can help prevent these chronic diseases and maybe reverse some of the age-related declines in immune function or energy metabolism. And so one dietary factor that we are particularly interested in is lipoic acid. And lipoic acid is a normal dietary factor, but if you give it in higher doses, it has all kinds of beneficial effects with respect to mitochondrial function, energy metabolism, inflammation, and the redox balance that is required for normal physiological function.
Well, I'm happy to say that I take it every day.
Oh, good.
And recommend it to my patients. So
yeah.
From what I hear, the case is not closed. The debate over the value of vitamin and mineral supplements is far from over, at least as far as the Linus Pauling Institute is concerned and you're concerned, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's so much else to do and to find out. I mean, vitamins and minerals are fascinating, and there's a lot to learn still about them.
Indeed. So what's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action? If listeners want to learn more about the research you're doing over there at the Linus Pauling Institute or about your writings, where can they access that?
Well, we have a website, lpi.oregonstate.edu, and on that website we have...
LPI?
LPI.oregonstate, in one word,
okay.
.edu.
Okay, and that's the LPI stands for Linus Pauling Institute, of course. LPI.oregonstate.edu.
Correct.
Okay.
And if you go to that website, there's one of the tabs on the left side that's called Micronutrient Information Center. And this is a very large database that describes basically the normal function, the dietary sources, and then the health benefits, both with respect to health promotion, but also disease prevention and disease treatment, of all the vitamins and minerals. So for each vitamin, vitamin C, vitamin B, vitamin B6, B12, and so on, we have a whole chapter that explains very carefully what the role of these vitamins is in the human body and in disease prevention and disease treatment. We have all the minerals listed there. We have chapters on multivitamin, multimineral supplements. We have some other nutrients, including lipoic acid, phytochemicals, certain foods and beverage. All in all, we have over 50 different chapters on all of these different dietary factors. This is a peer-reviewed website. It's scientifically accurate, it's up-to-date, and it's free. So it gets over 25 million hits a year. If you Google vitamin C, we are probably number 3 or 4 on the list popping up, and that connects you directly to the Micronutrient Information Center. It's our public face, and we know that a lot of health professionals actually use this website to get up-to-date information on dietary supplements, because they're often challenged by their patients.
Indeed.
And ask all kinds of questions, and they don't have the answers, but they can go to our Micronutrient Information Center and get all this information for free.
Well, would that more doctors access that, because all too often the response is, well, we don't know much about that. There's no scientific papers. Not enough research has been done, but yet there are these vast hidden repositories, best-kept secrets, like your website, obviously not so secret because it's been accessed 25 million times in a year, that are very comprehensive.
It is referenced. It is also referenced, yeah. So it's you know, as I said, peer-reviewed and referenced. And the reference is linked to PubMed, so you can actually look up the actual papers if you're interested. And there, for each chapter, you know, there are hundreds of references that we're citing. Each chapter is really a large review article. We could publish those probably if we wanted to in, you know, regular scientific journals, but we choose to just put them on the website and give access to everybody who is interested in this information for free.
Well, great. You're performing a wonderful service, and certainly we want to alert our listeners to that resource. And for listeners who want to look you up, simply Google Dr. Balz Fry. The spelling is B-A-L-Z, last name Fry, F-R-E-I. And I want to thank you very much, and congratulations on your superb research and your determination to get to the truth about the value of nutrients and their impact on health.
Great. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Balz Fry.
Yes.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.